So today we have Rob Coles on the Man V Life podcast, and I'm really excited to have him here because to me, Rob is someone who isn't in a world of social media where coaches have millions of followers. He's someone who isn't followed enough, in my opinion, and his work has really helped me get injury free and come over injuries, which are quite serious and really affected my life, let alone training, you know, sleep, traveling, that kind of thing. So I've seen the value in his knowledge and it's mind blowing. So I thought Rob has to be someone we use within Man V Life to educate our audience, and people have been loving his work. So I thought I'm going to get him on here today and talk all things about injury and injury prevention and that kind of thing. So Rob, would you like to give people a little bit of information about yourself as a coach and where your areas of expertise lies and kind of what you work on with people on a daily basis?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Firstly, thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure working with Man V Life over the last few months and stuff. It's good to see it grow. But so I suppose for me as a coach is that I met Adam, obviously, through a big gym in London where I was working there for about 4 or 5 years. So my area of expertise sort of essentially lie in sort of strength training, performance training, but it's sort of slowly digressed into rehabilitation. So a lot of the people I work with come to me, they've been training for a long time and they pick up little injuries, niggles, and they can no longer train as effectively or as they wish they should do. So I suppose where I sort of come in is I sort of blend in sort of trying to get people to train properly, to look after themselves and to manage any injuries that they may or may not have or be moving slightly towards. So I sort of, I liken myself to a bit of I abide by the laws of biomechanics quite a lot. So I always want to make sure the movement's good and that people are getting stronger and progressing, because what I tend to see is that people's training tends to be what sometimes breaks people down. So I try to guide people in the right direction, educate them, give them a bit more knowledge and hopefully get people so they can train and be healthy, be strong and not be hurt.
Absolutely. So if we go back, you mentioned when we met in start of 2014 when I was using W10, we used to work in Notting Hill to train someone for a men's fitness feature, which actually became a book. And I met you there and very quickly learned about your knowledge. And at the time I had, it was my lower back injury, which was quite bad. And that had caused me to have the left side of my lower back was injured, caused my left bicep tendon to become very tight, my left shoulder. So I had all sorts of things going on. My knee was a little bit dodgy, should we say, because of this one thing. And then when I met you, it just flipped my perspective. I was like, from the bodybuilding perspective, people would tell you to strengthen your lower back if it's injured, you know, hyperextensions and stuff. And when you're young, you think that's logical. As we're now, I think that's mental. You know, like just to do hyperextensions if you've got, you know, an injury in itself. So you flipped it around and said, right, there's like a chain, you know, it's almost like a domino effect happening here. That's caused by because of that. And it was very interesting. So if we use that as an example, because I'm pretty much cliche with the injuries I've had most injuries around joints and lower back pain, that kind of thing. Why do you think these things happen to a lot of people? And are they preventable, or is it part and parcel of being someone who lifts weights?
Well, I think that's probably one of the common flaws is that people think that because they lift weights, they almost wear their injuries as like a bit of a badge of honour. Yeah. So it's like they're always feeling beat up. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, your training should make you better. It shouldn't tear you down.
Yeah.
So like there's one thing. It's first of all, you need to distinguish the difference between an injury and soreness.
Absolutely.
So muscular soreness is something that you'd expect from any aspect of training.
Yeah.
If you've constantly got a niggle, or like what I've defined a niggle or a continuation of an injury,
yeah,
whether that be a knee, an ankle, or a shoulder, everyone's got one. Everyone that comes to see me, you talk to them and they're like, oh, my shoulder,
yeah,
you know, or my knee, or my back, you know. Well, this shouldn't be the case when you're training. At the end of the day, the goal of training is to make you better over the span that you do it. The unfortunate reality that I see through people's training is that they'll go through a spell of hard and fast training where they want to push themselves for 12 weeks, they get injured, they have to back off a little bit, they restart the whole process again, and it just ends up being a really bad sort of effect on the body.
I can relate.
So I mean, to get back to sort of what you were saying as the chain effect, and essentially what sort of happens is, A, it's always preventable in my opinion, unless there's been a high impact injury.
Yeah.
Most of it is prolonged wear and tear on joints.
Yeah.
under, and when you do that under load, that you start to accentuate stuff.
Yeah.
So as we sort of, when we looked at you, you're saying you're experiencing back pain, but then we noticed that one side of your hips was a lot tighter than the other one.
Yeah.
You know, so therefore when you squatted, you shifted.
Yeah.
When you shift over and squat, you're gonna twist a little bit. So also one thing always leads to another.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. I think C injuries is very much of an individual thing. So it's the moment you start to generalize, it's very difficult to sort of say anything that's going to be sort of any substance.
Yeah.
So like with you pointing case is that when we're looking at the back, it's all about understanding the loads that you're placing upon a system, yeah, on a joint structures. So for me, when it comes to the low back, is that first of all, most people that I see with, and I see a lot of people with low back. So the guy in the gym I work at now in London, the owner of that is probably the world's leading expert in back rehabilitation, or one of, you know, he lectures worldwide on how to prevent back pain and stuff like that and how to rehab it.
Yeah.
So working with him, you start to see a lot of people who have got these issues.
Yeah.
And one of the common things is that most people can't use their glutes.
Yeah.
So they don't know how to effectively hip hinge. So everything turns into quads and low back. And over time, that just overloads and tears down. And it just starts to break down that low back. And it's just poor mechanics at the end of the day. You know, it's like I see a lot of people don't take the time to understand the movements before they start to load these movements. That's probably the biggest thing that I see, is that people don't truly understand how to do a deadlift before they do a deadlift and before they start adding a lot of weight to it.
Yeah.
so over time, what tends to happen is we break ourselves down. And actually, if you just, and again, I think that just comes from a little bit of a short-sighted view of training. I mean, we all want results now, tomorrow, next week. Whereas actually, like, just have a longer view on it, a bigger picture view.
Yeah.
And just take the time to sort of nail the basics and really understand the movements before we start overloading these movements. You know, because at the end of the day, any movement done on the load is kind of cemented, whether be it right or wrong. You know, so that's where one of the biggest things I see go wrong with most people's training.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because it's quite funny, having learned a lot off you about this subject, because it became something I wanted to learn about when I got to the point where, I'll never forget this car journey from West Wales down to Sussex, so it's about 220 miles, and I had to stop, I think it was 6 or 7 times to stretch my back out in the car, and I couldn't drive in the end. I had to go in the passenger seat and recline the seat right back and, you know, lie down on the car park, stretch my back, and it was like, that was a low point. Bearing in mind, I was about 23, and it was like, this is mad. So I thought, I need to learn more about this. And then it was the following year and I really just started to discover the real reasons behind this stuff, and then it started to make sense, and then all of a sudden I could recognize where the weaknesses were. So when I came down to W10 that day, when you and I did a squat session, everything you were saying about my hip mobility on one side, my glutes firing, I could recognize that, and it was quite interesting. And then when I was doing exercises, I was conscious of what muscles weren't working, which were supposed to be working. And then last year, if you remember, I was doing a lot of rack pulls in the winter to gain some, you know, like trying to add some thickness marker back. And
yep.
I was going up to about 260 for 6 reps. And all of a sudden, I was getting like this decompression pain, wasn't I, in the back of my lungs. I was thinking, what's that? But that was, again, your opinion was, if I remember rightly, that the smaller muscles were, I'd kind of basically neglected them through kind of cliche bodybuilding training, built size and volumization in some capacity, but not built strength in the smaller, more intricate areas. So it was always leaving the weaker parts to more vulnerable to injury.
I was just going to say, when it comes to big compound movements like squats, deadlifts, rack pulls, like, especially when you go heavy, our body is always going to sort of lean towards the muscles that are strong. Yeah. So if you have someone like, let's just say a dead 50 kilos, your hamstrings and glutes can pick up 150 kilos, but your back can't stay extended under anything more than 60.
Yeah.
Well, anything that you lift over 60 kilos is going to be putting your back at jeopardy.
Yeah.
So you're no longer trained.
Not happening there.
Yeah, so when it comes to like rack pulls and squats and any sort of big compound movements, you're going to be sort of, your body's always going to lean towards using the bigger, more dominant muscles. So that's going to leave your weaker muscles sort of open to sort of issues. So I always liken it. So when it comes to like deadlifts, we use that as an example, is that so you might have a grip that's able to hold 150 kilos. You might have hamstrings that can lift 150 kilos. But if your low back like can't maintain extension under anything over anything more than 100 kilos, then anything you lift over that 100 kilos is now putting your lower back at jeopardy. So it's all about training. For me, training should be about bringing up your weaknesses and then developing your strengths. So if you do that, if you just bang your head against the sort of deadlifts and stuff like that, and overloading that low back, eventually it's gonna break down. And that's one of the things. I mean, I always liken it to a bit like tooth decay. It's like it doesn't happen overnight. It's something that happens over 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's what you see, is that people that have been lifting for a long time, lifting poorly, that's when these niggles start to come in. And it also then boils down to is that you then have to regress people, which nobody likes to do, because everyone's got a lifting ego to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And myself included, nobody wants to be told they can't do anything. Yeah. So then they just end up just plowing through it, you know? So instead of then looking at the weakest link, training that, bringing that up. And that's the big part of what I do. It's understanding the limitations of the body, putting them in a position where they can no longer cheat, and then strengthening those areas.
For sure.
You know, so that's the, when it comes to training, like that's why I'm not a huge fan personally of doing like a lot of volume in the compound movements.
Okay.
I mean, go heavy, but keep the reps lower.
Yeah.
And then train the heck out of like your back or whatever your weaknesses are to bring them up, which then over time will develop into a bigger squat, a bigger deadlift.
Yeah.
And so forth. You know, it's just, my sort of term I always use, it's all about training a bit smarter.
Yeah, for sure.
Rather than just banging your head against, just plowing into sort of squats, deadlifts and stuff. Because at the end of the day is that, for me, like injuries happen under fatigue.
Yeah.
So those big movements where you're taxing the body so much, if you can only do 5 good quality reps in a squat or a deadlift, and then you push through because you want mental toughness, those last 5 reps have done more harm than good, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, so you're breaking the body down.
Yeah. Makes total sense. So you talk about having to regress training. You remember back in the summer under your orders, I didn't train upper body for nearly 3 months. Yep. You know, when I say train, I didn't train it. It was just lower body work and trying to get mobility in my shoulder, because my right shoulder is my neck, wasn't it? Left side of my neck was in a lot of pain.
Well, I don't know if you got it confirmed, but it sounded to me like you'd sort of like slipped a disc in your neck. I mean, I don't know if that had been confirmed by the chiro. I mean, I wouldn't normally prescribe like nothing but rest to somebody unless there's something serious going on.
Like,
and to me, when you were sort of saying pins and needles down your arm and you can't get your shoulder above shoulder, like shoulder height, there's something seriously going wrong. And again, like this is something that I see a lot, is that you're going to have to hold your hands up there. You wanted to train through that.
Oh, I wanted to, I really, really didn't want to stop training. And this sounds insane, because when I say I've trained for 10 years, nearly 10 and a half years. So I'm accustomed to having, you know, you might have a niggle in the joint and stupidly like, oh, I'll carry on. But this was like, it was painful in my shoulder. And
yeah.
It was like chronically painful. And I was like, this is really bad. And it was the first injury I've ever had where I thought, you know what, this could actually get really, really serious. So that's when I spoke to you about it. But I really wanted to carry on, like I'd have carried on training all the muscles.
Because what a lot of people try and do is they try and find stuff that they can still do.
Well, that's what I'd have done. I'd have done everything which kind of didn't hurt, but I understand that's not the right move. Because the problem is it comes down to mentality. Like the gym for me, it's more of a therapy than just the physical side. So, I listened to you because I could see it was very serious. So why would someone
on the flip side of that, there are certain... Sorry, I saw you broke up there. Sorry.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so why would someone like me have mobility issues like that in my shoulder? And the reason I ask is I want you to explain, because I know how common that issue is with shoulder problems, especially in populations of men generally, who are kind of, you know, they've trained for a bit and gained a bit of muscle. Like, why do you see this happen all the time?
So with yourself, I think that there was some lifestyle things of sitting at a computer all day that caused your neck to be causing issues. But I don't see that very often. So in terms of shoulder, a lack of losing shoulder mobility, if we're talking about that, which is, I think, slightly different to what you had. When we're talking about that, then again, there's going to be a lifestyle factor in that. As the modern day, most people sit down for long periods of time. We have, unfortunately, internally rotated shoulders. We have a weak upper back. We have imbalances, you know, and one thing that if you look at any of the literature of regardless of what injury you're looking at, imbalances are one of the biggest predictors.
So
we know we've got that imbalance, and then you have a dominance of wanting to do a lot of like internally rotated movements, you know, which are chin-ups, which are bench presses, which are all this type of stuff, the vanity type training, bodybuilding training, if you will, and not doing enough to strengthen the back to bring your posture into better positions. So, I mean, I was having a conversation with you the other day about sort of, I mean, I see mobility restrictions as a strength issue. So I believe that your body doesn't like you to get into certain positions where you are weak. Your body at the end of the day doesn't want to be hurt. So if you lack overhead mobility or shoulder mobility, then just stretching the hell out of it isn't really the answer, because at the end of the day, your central nervous system, which is what governs muscle toneness and stuff like that, and stiffness and tension, is that if you can stretch it, and you might momentarily increase range of motion, but you haven't gained any strength in that end range of motion. So have a walk around and go back and retest, and I'm pretty damn sure after 3 or 4 minutes, you've lost it all again. You know, so because what happens is that if you bring your arm overhead and your body's unstable there, and your chance of injury goes up, your body's just at the end of the day just going to say, let's just tighten everything up in there and not allow us to get to that position. You know, and over time, this just gets worse and worse and worse unless we're doing something about it. You know, because if you push a dumbbell overhead and your body doesn't like to go there, like you're going to get hurt. You know, if you're not strong to stabilize that joint through that range of motion, then that's an injury waiting to happen, you know? So it's looking at, I mean, that's not to say that you shouldn't stretch, but you should also strengthen the newfound range of motion.
Yeah. Makes sense.
You know, and that's where I think some people fall out. They think because they've got tight hamstrings, they need to stretch their hamstrings more. But it's one of the things is that if you have a hard lower leg session on Monday and on Tuesday, you're stiff. That's when you should sort of stretch. You know, but if you're walking around with chronically tight hamstrings every day of the week, like, I'm not sure stretching is the answer. It goes a little bit deeper than that. You know, why are you tight? Why are your hamstrings tight? And for most people, it's going to be that their glutes are weak. You know, we spend all day long sitting down on our backside. We're not really doing much to sort of keep them strong. And then at the end of the day, if they're not weak, if they're not strong, then something's got to stabilize our pelvis. And that usually falls down to the hamstrings, you know? So then now we may be in a little bit of anterior pelvic tilt, which our hamstrings are now, they might feel tight, but they're actually in a lengthened position, which is why they feel tight. So sort of looking at other things, you know, there's a difference between I'm stiff, I need to stretch, and I can never get my arms overhead. You know, so it's always about understanding what's going on in the body and being able to look at that and correct it. And a lot of it comes down to individual exercise choice. You know, it's like what you were saying about like the hyperextensions and stuff like that. I mean, the hyperextensions are a great exercise, but if you're using your lower back to do the movement, you're doing it wrong. Because the hyperextension should be a hip, glute, a hamstring and glute exercise. Not a lower back extender. You know, and that's one of the things I see is that people have this tendency to want to move through their low back. The job of the abdominals, the low back, the erector spine is to stabilize the spine. We're not designed to massively load through flexion and extension of the spine. You need to build power through the hips. You know, so they all work to stabilize while the hips can do the work. And this is where something like what you were saying with the hyperextensions, that if you then lock your hips into place and then just extend through that back, that again, over time, that's going to have a very wearing effect on your discs and your back and stuff like that. And it's not going to end well, you know?
That's very, very interesting you say all this, because it's stuff which resonates with me, not just me. It's like I've worked in businesses where, which are largely bodybuilding demographics, and we see large scales of people, you know, from a similar demographic, and you see the same injuries over and over and over, to the point you can almost predict what's going to happen next. And I was kind of curious, because I used to think, oh, it's part and parcel, and then I thought, no, there must be a reason. There must be something doing this which can be avoided, or at least you can reduce the chances of. Because like you said, they're not a big impact exercise injury where, I don't know, say someone's squatting and for whatever reason they you know, tear their ACL or something for whatever reason, under huge load. It's not like that. It's kind of over a year, my knee pain has now got chronically painful. Not mine, you know what I'm saying? Third person.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, why is that happening? Because it must be something. It's a bit like a car, isn't it? If a tire's rubbing and then you don't address it and then 2 months down the line.
Well, again, like, when it's up, like looking at squats and knees and stuff like that is, again, it all comes down to the strategy that the individual is employing to move the weight. Yeah. You know, so a squat should be a hip dominant movement.
Yeah.
You know, your knees should transition forward slightly, but you should be sitting back and using the muscles of your hamstrings, your glutes a lot more than most people are.
Yeah.
So you watch people, if you were to watch most people squat in a local gym, they're just dropping their backside straight down, and that's putting a lot of shearing force on your knees.
Yeah.
You know, so you need, so again, the hamstrings and the glutes control a lot of the load, and your quadriceps work with them, not without them.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that if we use a strategy that is just very quad dominant, and let's face it, with modern lifestyle, everyone is quad dominant. You know, we say quad dominant, it's actually more hamstring posteriorly weak. You know, I don't think that the quads are massively strong. I just think the hamstrings and the glutes are weak.
Yeah.
So you take a body that has really weak hamstrings, really, really weak glutes, and then you tell it to perform a squat movement, your body's only going to know to use the quads.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to stand up out the bottom of a squat with only using your quads, your quadricep tendon, your patella tendon runs across the front of the knee. That's going to provide a huge shearing force on that knee.
Yeah.
So now you've got a very unbalanced knee joint at the bottom of a squat. So again, over time, it's just going to wear down. It's going to start with anterior knee pain. It's then going to transition into other things.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is what we need to sort of understand, is that this is where it boils down to really truly understanding the movements before we start to massively load them. Because the unfortunate reality with most programs is that everyone adheres to, and rightly so, like the thing is like progressive overload.
Yeah.
So you might not feel anything when you're squatting 40 kilos.
Yeah.
Then the next week you add 40, you got up to 45, you got up to 50. And all of this is kind of tolerable to your body until there's going to be some point when you're not squatting. If you're not squatting correctly, there'll be a breaking point. All of a sudden now your knee hurts.
Yeah.
You know, and then sort of you squat through it and it's fine. And then you get to the point where you can't squat without knee pain.
Yeah.
And again, like it's unfortunate because the answer isn't a quick fix. Everyone asks me, what's the best exercise to get rid of knee pain when you're squatting?
Yeah.
But the reality is, if you've got terrible squat technique and you've got this far, you've developed these huge imbalances where you don't have any hamstrings or glutes. So the answer is you need to go back and learn how to squat again and rebuild it all back up.
Yeah.
You know, because you watch any of the best squatters in the world, their knees don't travel forward very far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the further forward your knees travel in any movement, the more the quads are involved. If you look at, like, for argument's sake, a Romanian deadlift, for argument's sake, the knees don't travel forward very at all, or they shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And it's a very posteriorly dominant movement. But you flip that on the reverse and you put the bar into a front squat position, your knees go forward much more. That's a very, much more of a quad dominant movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when we squat, I don't want the knees to travel forward. So I mean, obviously it's going to differ from person to person and different limb lengths and stuff like that. But we need to teach people to sit back into the hips, use the glutes, use the hamstrings, and then use them to drive up out the bottom of the squat. And that's what's going to save our knees.
For sure. But you know? It's quite interesting when you were the first guy I trained with ever who, when we did that squat session, there's the first time I ever hit a 200 kilo squat was with you. It was the first time I did it. And I then went on, that was just before Christmas, and then I maxed out at 225 about 2 weeks later. And, you know, I was going fantastically well. But I remember telling you I developed pain in my right hip. And it wasn't bad. It was just kind of like a little pinch. And then that obviously became a problem over a period of time where it got to a point where I squat and I'd anticipate the pain as I get to the bottom, I twist because it would pinch and then it'd make my body react to it. And what you're talking about, breaking points there, the ego inside me was like, just keep pushing because you can lift the weight, because it wasn't stopping me lift the weight. But the kind of the more educated part of me that came later in life through meeting you was, I need to address why I'm getting this pain. So for me, I guess I'm an example of a lot of different injuries through making mistakes. And I want to tell people really and educate them that you don't have to go through this if you haven't already. And I, as a little bit older, nearly 27 years old now, it's like, try and look after yourself. Otherwise, you will get to this point where you now have to go backwards to go forwards again. So, you know, the time will come, won't it? If you don't take care of the, take care of your joints, it will come.
I like in the, when you're talking about sort of the system, is that I always look at, we have hardware and software, the way that's how I look at it in the body. So the hardware will be the joints, the muscle system, all the physical elements.
Yeah.
And then the software is how we overcome a movement strategy from how our brain, what muscles our brain wants to use to, from anything from bending down to pick up a pen all the way through to performing a deadlift. So that's our software. So what is our go-to movement pattern to do a Romanian deadlift, for argument's sake? And most people's software doesn't match what they believe that they're doing a movement correctly when actually they're not. You talk to some people and you say, you get them to do a deadlift and you say, right, now straighten out your back. And they're like, it is straight. And you're like, actually it's not, you know? It's sort of, that's where it comes back to sort of learning and retraining the body, relearning the movement. Because like the thing I always sort of really like is that the motto that I sort of go by is, first of all, you've got to learn to do it well. Then you learn to do it fast, and then you learn to do it heavy.
Yeah.
You know, so you go through that system with everything you're doing, and actually you'll be a lot better and a lot safer for longer. You know.
Yeah, for sure. So, in terms of, I know there's like a million questions to answer within this topic, but the one thing which you've already discussed, which seems so common, is a lack of glute and hamstring strength, right? And activation more than anything, because people can't actually make them. The example I give for training with someone is that I believe in terms of hypertrophy, which is slightly different to what you're talking about in terms of sarcoplasmic hypertrophy. If you can't make a muscle hurt or burn within 10 or 15 reps without any weight, I don't think you're particularly efficient at making that muscle work for growth purposes. You know, you should be able to make it really like burn without any weight through your ability to recruit that muscle. Through going through the reps without weight. And I don't think people are particularly good at activating the hamstrings. They might do 10 reps with a tiny weight and it doesn't hurt. There's nothing, you know, there's no feel. Therefore, I feel that tells us something. As if they do quads for 10 reps or 20 reps, their quads are on fire, right? What would your advice be to someone who, and I know it's a case-by-case study, but as a broad stroke, what would you say is the go-to approach for building hamstring and glute strength within a program, and then exercises, application, that kind of thing?
Okay, so the first thing you have to understand is that you need to learn how to use the hamstrings and the glutes, first of all, in a given movement. So a simple hip hinge drill, which is where you might put like a dowel rod along your spine and going back through into sort of like an RDL.
Yeah.
Like if when that done correctly on somebody that has a very underactive hamstring and glute, if you perform high reps in that, they will be sore for weeks.
Yeah.
Like with zero weight, because now they're learning to do it. Because when you watch someone do this movement, they're going to start to move their knees backwards, forwards throughout the movement.
Yeah.
And the true hip hinge movement, the knees should stay perfectly still.
Yeah.
So you need to control your knees to be able to use your hamstrings.
Okay.
Okay. So for me, if anyone has an issue with the hip hinge, like, so they can't hip hinge effectively, can't use the hamstrings, then they need to learn how to do that. And that's a skill. So that's something you can practice every day to a certain degree.
Yeah.
You know, so I put that in people's warm-ups. So that should be like, when you're warming up, learn to do the movement pattern you're trying to, because I still do this in my own warm-up, you know, and I'm a more advanced lifter, you know, and I don't have an issue with the hip hinge, but I want to make sure that before I go into deadlifts, I've re-ingrained that movement pattern, and me sitting down for the last 6 hours or whatever, hasn't brought in that I've forgotten how to do the movement. So it's stick to the basics. So you've got to warm up. So the warm up is for me the biggest thing that most people do. It's always the first thing that people cut out when they're in a hurry. But it's actually probably the most important part of the workout, because if you, again, from just talking sort of generally, most people spend a lot of their day sitting down. So if that's the case, I already know that their posterior chain isn't firing. So if you're going to go and deadlift, you haven't set yourself up optimally to perform. So a 10-15 minute warm up to address that movement pattern, to address the hamstrings, to stress the glutes, and over time they're going to get stronger. So that's one of the biggest things I've done in the last sort of year with my clients and athletes that I train is I employ sort of like a weakness warm up. So I'll pick three exercises for that individual, and I'll make them do like low loads. So if you're talking hamstring curls or whatever, it'll be seriously light, like 20 kilos or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll make them do 25 reps of all three of those exercises, and they'll do four reps before they even touch anything.
Yeah.
So for most people, that's more volume than they'll ever do anyway. So they've just done 100 reps with 20 kilos on the hamstring curl, which isn't heavy. So it shouldn't be heavy. You should be able to do almost like 50 reps straight off the bat.
Yeah.
But they've done 25 reps. They've gone through a little sort of like warm-up circuit. And by the end of it, they've done 300 reps of good quality movements that have primed them for their session.
Yeah.
You know, so initially that might be more volume than they're used to.
Yeah.
And it might take away from the main session in the short term. They might not go into that sort of session deadlifting as much as they normally can. But if you think about the amount of volume that they are going to accumulate over, if they do legs twice a week, for argument's sake, and they do that warm up twice a week, 52 weeks of the year, like the amount of volume, again, if we're talking hypertrophy, so it's low load. We use that hamstring example for argument's sake. We use 20 kilos on a leg curl.
Yeah.
You have done 20,000 kilograms or 2,000 kilograms of hamstring curls.
Yeah.
In session one, so you're doing 4,000 kilograms a week times 52.
Yeah.
You've accumulated a serious amount of volume there.
Yeah.
That have now conditioned your hamstring to be strong.
Yeah.
But it hasn't impacted the session, or it shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's one thing that I've employed. So whether it be hamstring curls, hip hinges, like light good mornings or light RDLs, anything like that, when done correctly, is just going to switch all those muscles on. So that's the first thing that I've sort of seen I've done and implemented that's made a huge difference to some of the guys I work with.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only does it bring up the strength of those muscles, but it also brings up the conditioning of those muscles. Like what I was saying before, injuries happen in a state of fatigue, in my opinion, for most part. So if you can improve the time it takes for a muscle to get to fatigue, then that's good, in my opinion. Then when you're going out running, sprinting or whatever, it's like you're conditioned, you know? So that's the first one. The second one is your assistance exercise. So if you're doing a leg day, let's just, for argument's sake, and you've chosen you're doing squats or deadlifts on that day as your main exercise.
Yeah.
All the other stuff should be working your week from your first weakness down. So you need to train every part of your body, like your legs or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you've highlighted that your hamstrings are the weakest link, then you need to do a hamstring dominant movement first, where you put your most energy in when you're at your freshest. And then you work through. So you're doing your calves at the very end, for argument's sake.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? So you're working through, you're going hamstrings, and that might be RDLs, glute ham raises, whatever it might be. And then you're going into a glute exercise or a glute dominant movement. Then you might do some back extensions if that's what you, blah, blah, and then you go through.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that I always look for when I'm programming is I'm looking, you only have so much energy to use in any training session.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to put the majority of that training session into the big lifts and then what is the primary port of call in terms of your weaknesses.
Can I quickly jump in? And ask
because
you
most people
with the leg programming, it's kind of relevant to this, is then you carry on, is why is it that a lot of coaches who are strength-based like yourself put a lot of value on training hamstrings before quads in a leg workout in terms of knee health? What's the reasoning behind that? I know it's quite a common thing.
Well, so basically when it comes to performance, it's going to be very much down to that, is that everyone is quad dominant. So why do you want to train the quads other than an aesthetic point of view?
Yeah.
You know, because they don't, like, they're not making you squat more. They're not making you squat more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not why you're not squatting more or deadlifting more.
Yeah.
You know, so that's very much from a aesthetics point of view, is you want to train your quads. So performance has to, in my opinion, performance has to come before aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so because if, like what you were saying, is that if we can make your hamstring strong, so we know that if you look at like sort of the research that's been done on ACLs, for argument's sake, one of the biggest predictions is having valgus of the knee and being poor recruiters of the hamstring and glutes. So even from a very preventative nature of training, is that you want to make sure the hamstrings are getting stronger and stronger and stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So for most people, they are hugely quadricep dominant. And you look at some of the strongest people in the world, their hamstrings will be ridiculous. They'll be able to do Nordic curls. They look at some of the top sprinters in the world, they'll be able to do that where they touch their nose and pull straight back up.
Yeah.
You know, so the goal always has to be is to make the hamstrings and the glutes stronger.
For sure.
Very rarely do I want to make somebody's quads stronger. I want to work the quads, and yes, I've got nothing against like leg extension and stuff like that, but that's not where I want to put the bulk of my energy in a training session.
Mm-hmm.
I want to put that towards what's going to keep you healthy, keep you lifting. Because at the end of the day, like again, like one of the best quotes I've ever heard is that the person that lifts the longest will get the strongest.
Yeah.
So if you pan out and you take a much bigger view on training, is that who's going to be in the better shape? The guy that trashes himself for 12 weeks and then gets injured and can't train for 3 or 4 of them,
yeah,
or the guy that slowly plods along for 4 or 5 years and stays injury free and is deadlifting insane weights in year 4, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like that guy there is going to be a lot healthier, a lot more built. He's not going to have injuries. He's going to have more training consistency, you know, because the quickest way to become weak and out of shape is to get injured.
Yeah, I know that.
You know? So So the goal should always be look after your body, train the weakest link. Like, yeah. And again, like let's face it, like I was an Olympic weightlifter for 7 years and I hated training my upper body.
Mm-hmm.
And because I wasn't very good at it, like I didn't do much upper body work. Like Olympic lifting is mainly legs,
yeah.
And I had strong legs. I could squat lots, so I hated training it.
Mm-hmm.
But like I ended up having a lot of shoulder issues because of it. And since now I've focused a lot more on upper body, I haven't had any shoulder issues.
Yeah.
You know, but we always gravitate towards what we're good at.
Of course. And
the reason people don't like doing hamstring work are the people that aren't very good at hamstring work.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't an excuse not to train it. You know, and that's the unfortunate reality is that your training should be made up majority of stuff that you're absolutely rubbish at,
mm-hmm,
because you want to get better at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like for a long time, I was absolutely terrible at chins. So chins were never in my program.
Yeah,
wonder why I'm, you know, so it takes that time. It's taken me nearly a year to actually enjoy training upper body.
But do you know,
but then when you start,
was the same for me, mate. In 2014 is when I started squatting about 4 months before I saw you for that session. I'd done some squatting, obviously very sporadically over my life, but I never enjoyed it because I wasn't particularly good at it. And it's because of mainly dorsiflexion deficit, you know, like having terrible mobility in my ankle. And I had Achilles issues as a teenager playing football. So I think it might have derived from that.
Yeah.
And that was quite bad. And basically when I came to squat, I was like, it didn't interest me because I didn't feel I could be good at it. And I kind of like was, no, you need to get your act together. And then very short space of time, I got very strong on them. But there was obviously a negative to that because of the approach at the time, I suppose, was more focused on the performance than how my hamstrings were firing at the time. But it's just very interesting, isn't it? How you do definitely avoid doing what you're bad at, and then that generally is where the problems come in at a later date then.
I mean, but that's also a lesson that you can take outside the gym. I mean, like the old saying of like the magic happens outside your comfort zone. You know, as humans, we want to stay in stuff that we are comfortable in environments we are comfortable in. But actually, it's when you go outside of them that you get the best results.
Yeah.
You know, so it's no different in the gym, is that as people, we gravitate towards stuff that we're good at. Like if you can bench 2 times body weight, guess what you're doing every time you're in the gym? You're benching, because it's impressive.
Yeah.
And B, you enjoy doing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But if you do that at the expense of other areas, then eventually you're going to break down and you're no longer going to be able to do what you enjoy. You know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
It's all about taking a much bigger picture view on training and lifestyle, because at the end of the day is that if you can't recover from training, then there's an issue there. And sometimes for most people, for a lot of people I see, is that the recovery aspect of training is something that is hugely neglected.
Yeah.
So it's just you've got to take that overview on the whole training picture, and you've got to bring up the areas of your weakness, like your weaknesses, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So what, continuing with the glute and hamstring process that you'd put in place, you've covered some of the points you put in. What's the rest of that puzzle?
I mean, the rest of when it comes to training the glutes and hamstrings, if you've got terrible glutes and hamstrings, then like for everyone that I train, they have to learn how to deadlift sumo.
Yeah.
Sumo takes a lot of the stress off the low back. It challenges your hip mobility and it overloads your glutes. So momentarily, for a short period of time, if you're not very good at sumo, you're going to be weaker.
Yeah.
But the sumo will transfer hugely to the conventional deadlift. But in the meantime is that you are going to develop hip mobility, end range strength in that mobility.
Yes.
And you're going to take a lot of the stress off the low back. So if that's one thing that I really liked for developing the glutes, learning how to sumo deadlift properly and stuff like that. The other one is most of my programs are made up of like special exercises. So I like sort of like RDLs and stuff like that when done correctly, but I go a little bit lighter and a bit like what you were saying, focus on the movement rather than usually just trying to lift as much weight as possible. Mm. Like exercises, like machines, like reverse hypers, if your gym's fortunate enough to have one of them, glute ham raises. So exercise muscle. So a lot of the stuff I use will be very isolation type exercises. So like the glute ham raise, for argument's sake, it's an isolated movement for the hamstrings and the glutes.
Yeah.
You know, because you try and do anything else that's a much more of a compound movement, like I was saying, your body's going to gravitate towards the strongest area.
Yeah.
You know, so it's your, I'm trying to put the body in a position that it can't help but strengthen the weakest link.
Yeah. Yeah, so for that's, sure that, makes sense.
So when it comes to like exercise selection, again, that for me is a hugely individual thing because A, what equipment do you have? B, what's your mobility range of motion like? Because again, like moving on is that for some people that have got a shoot, like haven't got very mobile hips.
Yeah.
First, they might not be able to deadlift from the floor.
Yeah.
That's a simple fact. And also, I mean, I stand at a lofty 5'8", which deadlifting from the floor for me is an absolute ease.
Yeah.
But if you're 6'4",
yeah,
like that's going to be a bit more of a struggle for you. You know, it's so again, it's looking at individuals, and because for them people, they might thrive hugely by just raising the deadlift bar up like onto blocks.
Yeah.
You know, and just learning that, and over time you'll be able to bring it down to the floor once the movement's good. But if you're forcing an issue, you could be doing yourself some harm, you know?
Yeah, the one thing which I've done this year, I've spent a lot of time trying to just improve my activation in my hamstrings, because that was definitely a thing for me. And there's a couple of things that I've noticed just through analysing myself, you know, and kind of feedback from the workout. And I'm very much into seeing how I feel from doing something and what I can feel happening within different parts of the muscle as I'm training it, is that so I started doing lots of, I suppose, high rep to an extent, not high rep, you know, 15, 20 rep sets on standing single leg curls, but very lightweight, and you know, with isometric stuff. So I was trying to teach the hamstring to fire, you know.
I use that a lot with I train a few track athletes.
Yeah.
So I'll use that with them. So they'll like, I'll condition their hamstrings to the point where they can do 200 single leg hamstring curls on each leg every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's something I do myself. I'll do 200 hamstring, again, like using little to no weight, like on the standing hamstring curl.
Very
like
little weight, yeah, yeah.
5, 10 kilos.
That's right.
But learn to activate and fire, because also what the high rep stuff, it builds up the ligament and tendons.
Yeah.
So for most people, especially when you're going into more sarcoplasmic hypertrophy work, is that you're building up the muscle tissue. You're stressing the muscle tissue.
Yeah.
Like the tendons and ligaments and tendons take a lot higher volume. They require a lot more time, a lot higher volume to develop that strength.
Yeah.
So you've got to look after both aspects of that structure.
Yeah.
So for me, is that the high rep stuff, like even like little people that haven't got a hamstring curl, what I do is I get them to buy like 5 kilo ankle weights.
Yeah.
Lay onto a bench and just do fast hamstring curls.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, and what that does is that 50 reps at a time, like 4 rounds of 50 reps.
Yeah.
Like it builds up their tendons and the back of their hamstrings, you know, and I found that to be like for keeping people healthy. That's one of the best, like one of the best things I've done.
Yeah. For me, it's like my hamstrings have grown better this year. And obviously it's not through just that because of the weight. I mean, it's purely the activation, what I was talking about earlier, being able to feel the muscle actually work. So you get, you know, there's a pump there and it's burning and it's like, wow, the muscle's actually working, rather than kind of, we've all lifted weight in the past and not felt anything for it. And it's, yep. That's, to me, that's wrong. If you're trying to build muscle, you should feel it.
Exactly. But what you were saying is that like using that for more of an activation purposes, when you come off that, you've been doing X amount every day for a period of time, and you step up to a deadlift bar to try and deadlift.
Yep.
Guess what? Like your hamstrings are now pretty tuned up. Like
yep.
They're going to be much more involved in a deadlift.
Yep.
It's going to leave you being much safer, and you're potentially going to lift more weight. So
yeah. So I've got two questions for you here on topic hamstrings. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really cool topic because it affects nearly pretty much everyone because they're not good at making their hamstrings work. And I think that it's relevant for most people. And I think I'm going to ask these questions based on my findings and also people I've trained with and do train. But I think, again, a lot of guys listening to this who read the magazine are going to be like, yeah, yeah, I find that. So firstly, when doing – I hate seated leg curls. I'll only do front lying ones or standing mm-hmm. ones.
Yeah.
I don't rate seated leg curls at all.
No.
So – and you can explain why after better than me. But basically, I find there's two things that happens when I do leg curls, whether that's lying or standing. And I think this is down to being quad dominant, and you can say if so. I find that when doing standing, I struggle to get a full range of motion to the top, even with no weight, a tiny amount of weight, getting my ankle up towards my backside. You know, it's like it's restricted to go as far as it probably should, because my quads feel very, you know, tight around the knee, I guess. Not painful. It's just kind of there's not a lot of movement there compared to what it might appear. And secondly, doing lying leg curls, I have to try really hard to not get a pump in my lower back, if that makes sense. And my form is very tight. It's very controlled. So it's not, I'm not one of those people who's yanking the weight and letting my lower back come right up in the air, my stomach off the bench. It's not that, but I still have to try very hard. So what, in your opinion, is happening there to cause those two things? Because I think they're both super common occurrences.
So the first one, when you're talking about doing a standing hamstring curl, is that most people don't have great range in quad flexion, in knee flexion anyway.
Yeah.
So if I was to lay someone down with most everyone, I'd take them through a big assessment. And then one of the standard ones is just the knee flexion. And most people laying on the floor completely relaxed can't get their heel to their butt.
Yeah.
And that's going to be down to, yes, like what you were saying. So it's some tension through the front of the quads.
Yeah.
Just they're being tight because like your body doesn't like going anywhere it's never been before.
Yeah.
So that's something that has to be trained. So you can do if you stand there like now and you try and pull your heel to your backside, you'll end up getting hamstring cramp.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't like go, but that's something that you might want to try and do to try and develop that range of motion if it's necessary. Because if you're going to maximum velocity sprints, that might be somewhere that you get forced into. I mean, ideally you wouldn't, but that might be, and that's when you're going to be injured.
Yep.
You know, so it's looking at stuff like that. So that's that one there. And also what happens is that when you're standing in that thing, you're fighting gravity as well. So you're being forced in to try and pull up against the whatever weight you're using plus gravity, which obviously isn't the case when you're laying down, because gravity is pushing us the other way, right?
Yeah.
So when it comes to the lying hamstring curls, again, you're naturally the most hamstring curls, lying hamstring curls, have put you into a little bit of hip flexion.
Yeah.
Is that so you're slightly sort of butt up in the air anyway.
Yeah.
So then what happens is that as you come to that end range, you're trying to use your low back to try and get that pad all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So I would get you to cut the repetition slightly short to take that low back out of it, or stick your butt up in the air a little bit higher by putting something underneath your hips.
Oh, right. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
You know, just trying that. All it's going to do is change the angle of the pull.
Yeah.
So it's changed the load on the joint and get you to recruit hamstrings in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a common, but then your hamstrings, your glutes and your low back are, they should work together and everything. But if you're getting to the point of fatigue where your hamstrings are tired.
Yeah.
That's another thing, is that then your body's going to move to the next strongest muscle group.
Yeah.
Your glutes have been taken out of the equation because you're in a little bit of hip flexion.
Yeah.
So then it's going to be slightly shifted to your low back.
Yeah.
You know, so again, that's something you want to avoid. So if you start to get that low back pump on 15 reps, you want to be doing 12 rep sets.
Yeah.
You know, because that's when your hamstrings are fatiguing and that's when your lower back's taking over. You know, that might then be able to be progressed after a couple of weeks where you can now do 15 reps or 20 reps without your low back coming into it.
Yeah.
And that's built, and that's the progression.
For sure. Is there an argument to say don't go beyond failure? With your hamstrings, I mean, once you start feeling your lower back, obviously stop rather than keep going if you can do more reps, because then it's not really loading the target muscle, is it?
The thing is that it's quality over quantity all the time.
Yeah.
So if you're using a lying hamstring curl, you're using it to strengthen your hamstrings. If all you feel now is your low back, you're no longer strengthening your hamstrings, and there are much better exercises to strengthen your low back.
Yeah.
So you might as well stop when you feel that those hamstrings come to an end.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's something I employ from everyone, regardless of who I use. Case in point was I worked with a 10K runner, and he always used to complain that when he ran over 8 kilometers, he started to get low back pain.
Yeah.
So I got him on a treadmill, and we're fortunate to have a manual assisted treadmill. So not like your standard belt driven ones.
Yeah.
So I got him running on there, and when it got to about 4 kilometers, his technique changed. So he started to drop his hip a little bit. So basically what was happening is that from 4 kilometers to 8 kilometers, he was sort of hanging in there. And at 8 kilometers, he was then like compensation had kicked in and his low back started to ache. So anything over 4 kilometers was breaking him down.
Amazing.
So what I did was I pulled him back and I said, right, you're... Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. So what I did was get him to sort of reduce his running. So I got him to get down to the track. And so we said that like 3,000 kilometers is where he kind of got to the point where he's starting to slip. So I got him to do 2,000 meter repeats.
Yeah.
So he didn't run more than 2,000 meters in one go. So we do 2,000 meters, rest for 2 or 3 minutes, go again. And gradually we built that back up to the point where he could run 12, 15K and not feel his low back.
Wow.
You know, so what was happening is that he would get to a point of fatigue in his running gait. Compensation would kick in. He would then like refer to a different movement pattern, compensation movement. That would then lead to fatigue and cause aching and stuff in his low back. Well, the answer isn't to run more. It's actually to run less. But you can build volume up in so many different ways. You know, and I use this with people's squats. If people's squat technique changes after 5 reps,
yeah,
you know what? You're going to do 10 sets of 3 reps. You still get 30 reps. Your volume is still incredibly high. And all you can do is you can reduce that rest down between those sets.
Mm-hmm.
So the quality stays super high. Every rep is perfect. And now you're training in a much more optimal environment.
Yep.
To get strong. Because the thing is with pain is that pain is one of the best muscle inhibitors you will ever find. It shuts down muscles around that area. And now you are more likely to get injured.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why niggles and knee pain, like if you have knee pain, your hamstrings aren't going to work optimally. You know, you're not going to load that knee as efficiently as you should do.
Yeah.
So therefore, doing stuff through pain is only further ingraining a movement deficiency.
Got you.
So that's the issue with training through pain strategy is that I don't believe that to be the case, is that you always want to be training in an optimal environment and not breaking yourself down.
Yeah. Okay.
You know? More isn't always better. See, more isn't always better with training.
Yeah. So, whilst I eat my pre-workout meal, I've got another question for you. This is something which is a little bit different, but I think this is something that's going to land very much within your field. So, and I keep referring to myself purely to let listeners relate, because I do believe a lot of the things I've experienced, whether it's niggles or injuries, are they're common. It's not like they're unique problems to me or anything like that. You know, it's quite common. I'll give an example then. So talk about muscles being inhibited, okay? When I train my calves, my right calf, from the right to the left side, all the way up to the out head, complete tension, ability to create tension, you know, real quality feel all through the muscle. My left calf, the outer head, very little feel in it. And it's almost like a numb feeling. And I can barely push my left foot outwards, externally rotate it without, I've always got a pull down the left side of my ankle. And when I do cardio, this will really hurt if I'm doing power walking, for example. Not agony, but it's really uncomfortable. And obviously that's related. So, and the front of my calf then, so the front of my shin, sorry, you know, the muscle runs down the shin on the outer, that always kind of aches when I do cardio. So there's obviously something going on there. And the reason I say that, I bet so many guys listen to this, like, yeah, me too. So, and I believe that inhibits hypertrophy, because the tension, the blood flow, everything into the muscle is definitely going to be inhibited. So what's going on there? What is your kind of action to fix something like that?
Well, the first thing I would look at would be what's going on at that hip, because the first thing that you mentioned was when you were talking about your calf, my mind went directly to the hip, and I was thinking about what side of your low back was going with, like, years ago.
Left side, the same side.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got some neural issues going down that left side, in my opinion. There's something definitely going on down there. I mean, it's hard to obviously say without assessing you and seeing what's going on.
Yeah.
But the first thing is that, like, obviously everything is inherently linked. So if your glute's not firing, it's going to compensate through through recruiting something else, and then your calf's not in an optimal position to fire. And if you've got tension running, radiating down that whole leg, then nothing can really fire. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you'd have to look at is what's going on there. So you might need to get some, I don't know, like some ART, some soft tissue work, some mobility, some stretch work. That might all come in handy. But it's all having a look as to what's going there, because also, I mean, if that continued, I'd want to see, like, if you're in pain when you walk, your tibialis anterior, so the muscle in the front of the shin aching, that tends to ache, in my opinion, because it has, it's restricted. So if your calf's really tight, the tibialis anterior has to work harder to dorsiflex your foot. So then that gets tired when you do prolonged cardio exercise. So
that's exactly what's happening.
So then, like, the first thing I would recommend is always, like, you need to get some soft tissue work done.
Yeah.
I mean, the unfortunate reality is that most people that are training the most are the last ones who want to go and get a massage.
Do you know what? When I lived in Surrey, there's a guy called Adrian Jenkinson. And if anybody lives in, I tell you what, not Surrey, anyone that lives within 2 hours of the guy, go see him. I travel from West Wales to see him sometimes. He is a genius, and with soft tissue work, and he made a massive impact on my back and shoulders. I used to have 2 appointments a week with him. It wasn't like, oh, see me for X amount of weeks. I just made a habit of seeing him every week, twice a week. And I saw that as like a, like service in your car and nutrition, you know, it's just part and parcel of the lifestyle. It wasn't like something I felt I had to do for X amount of time. It was maintenance. And I highly recommend anyone has soft tissue work, and it isn't something I got into till I was about 24. But I highly recommend it. I think it's absolutely life-changing with pain recovery and performance as well.
I think people should make like the soft tissue work a huge part of their actual program. So I'm not saying that you have to get it done twice a week, but you need to, every other week, you need to make sure, and find a good one, because unfortunately they're not all good.
I've seen some crap ones as well, but he was
find people that understand the body, that know what's going on. And actually, like, what I've found is that if you can find someone that understands training, that's even better. You know, so find people that actually train themselves, and actually then get them to work through the areas, because they're going to know where you're tight, what's going on. You know, and like they're going to be doing the right things to do it, because the unfortunate reality is that we get some soft tissue therapists who don't understand training.
Yeah,
is that they don't always understand what you're putting your body through on a day to day.
Yeah,
you know, and that can be a negative as well. So I mean, I always sort of like people like to sort of find someone that understands training.
Yeah, the beauty of working with Adrian, you know, is his therapy room was attached to the gym I trained at.
Easy.
So he would often take me into the gym during our session, try me out on certain exercises and take me back and work on. So he was constantly like breaking down areas where he felt were a problem. And the big one he worked on for me was scapulas, lots of scar tissue around my scapulas. So that improved scapular retraction massively, range of motion at my shoulder massively. And, you know, I remember going in the gym to do pull-ups with him, and I could do twice as many pull-ups as I usually could, purely by making my shoulders move properly. It was like I had lost 30 kilos in weight.
That's a sign of a good therapist, though, you know. That's a sign
incredible.
Of someone that knows what they're doing. And so, yeah, I mean, that's one thing is that, and also we'll just change it, like going back a little bit, is that just looking at that is that therapy and rehabilitation and all this type of stuff that we've been covering is inclusive into training. Because I think one of the common mistakes that people make is that they think rehab and training are almost different entities.
Yeah, you know, think it happens, don't they? They think once I'm injured.
Yeah, your training should be preventative. You know, your training should be rehab, you know, and rehab should be training.
Yeah.
Because if you're training correctly and you're strengthening your weak areas, you're actually making yourself more resilient to injury, not pushing yourself further towards, you know. So that's one of the things that I think where some people sort of get messed up is that they get injured, they go to see a physio, they get them back, they're no longer in pain, and then they go back to doing what they were doing. But the issue was what they were doing was what broke them in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. So the whole process starts again.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's just about sort of looking after yourself, training, because most people make a large investment in terms of time and energy into training, and then they're not doing anything like what we were talking about, the soft tissue work, they're not doing stuff to give back and sort of look after themselves, and that over time, leads, can lead to some problems.
And like you said about the neurological side of things, like I'm My background's more, I'm not a bodybuilder, you know, not a competitive bodybuilder. It doesn't interest me, in fact, to compete, but that's very much my background. I've been around some of the best bodybuilders in the world, best coaches in the world. They're, you know, very good friends of mine. And the one thing I've always focused on since I was very young was, you know, tension and control.